Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. It's that time of year again. Okay, well, every 4 years, that is. Not the elections, the Olympics, where the world will gather in the spirit of goodwill in competition, or so we're told. But is that truly the case? Today, we'll examine the upcoming Paris Summer Olympics and whether sports is just a euphemism for politics and running shoes. All right, let's get into the MO. Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, has spent billions of dollars in citywide upgrades in and around Paris in preparation for the 2024 Olympic Games. While this is a lot of money, it's par for the course for any host city. But the City of Light is coming under fire for leaving the world in the dark about the city's homeless population, who are getting bussed out far and away from Paris, as officials expect 15 million tourists to descend on the French capital. Meanwhile, as wars rage on in Gaza and a prolonged conflict anticipated in Ukraine, the International Olympic Committee is drawing ire from activists who say the IOC is playing favorites with Israel and being hypocrites with Russia. Joining us to discuss is a dear friend of mine who happens to be a dual French-American citizen. It's Ted Rall. He's the co-host of Sputnik Radio's Final Countdown show. He's a syndicated cartoonist and author of several books, including To Afghanistan and Back. Ted, always glad to speak with you.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So the 2024 Paris Olympics, they're just around the corner. Like any other host city to the Games, you know, they try to clean up, they ratchet up security. Terrorism is always a threat at big events like this. But there are some reports that have emerged around, you know, 100 days or so ahead of the Games that Emmanuel Macron had dozens and dozens of homeless migrant families removed from the area near Paris City Hall. Now, I would compare this to when the California governor, Gavin Newsom, magically got rid of San Francisco's homeless problem ahead of Xi Jinping's visit for the APEC summit. What do you make of France's preparations for the Olympics?
Yeah, and my thought went to when New York Mayor Giuliani was hosting the Republican National Convention, or I'm sorry, that was Mayor Michael Bloomberg. And he also had the homeless people removed and exiled to the boroughs outside of Manhattan of New York City. As you say, Manila, this is something that happens whenever a city hosts a major event, whether it be a major sporting event like the Olympics or a political convention or whatever. No one wants to see the riffraff around. And I think, you know, it's not unusual. Now, what a lot of people might not know about Paris is that it really has long had a major problem with homelessness. When I was a kid, the first time I went, it was this will date me, I'm 60 years old. In 1973, I went with my mom and I was 10. And I remember seeing like these bums is the only word you could say, basically sleeping on the wall, the retaining wall over the Seine River. And my mom said, those in French, she said, those are the clochards, which basically means, homeless guys. They were all alcoholics and they would sleep up there. And I was always kind of amazed that they just didn't just roll over to their deaths and fall like 60 feet down to the pavement or depending on the tide into the water. And it must have happened, this is for people who know Paris. This is that area of the Seine where they have all the book stalls that are like locked up against the Seine River. Homelessness has long been an issue and there's a lot of poverty in Paris. Paris is a very expensive city. And so it's housing prices are through the roof. And then there's also a culture of housing hoarding in France. So what I mean, you would be amazed. It's probably reasonable to assume that fully 40% of housing stock in Paris is vacant at any given time. So what happens is when you inherit a house or an apartment in France, you don't sell it. Like, you know, my mom died and the house that I grew up in Ohio, what's the first thing I did? I took the stuff that I wanted and put it on sale. That's the American way, right? Not there. In France, however, I inherited a little plot of land in Brittany from my grandparents. I kept that because that's the French way. So it's just sitting there empty. So all over France, people have like properties. Many people have 3-4 homes that they never go to, and they just sit empty. There are, I know one of my relatives, he literally has the childhood home that he grew up in, like frozen in amber, since like across the street from his house. It's kind of amazing. If you want to know like what a house looked like in the 1960s in France, you just go into his house. He never goes there, ever. It's just there. It's the French way. So the point is that like homelessness is a massive problem there. They don't build they really don't build enough new housing. There's not enough public housing. So yeah, I mean, obviously you could see why Macron would not want those people out there.
Now, what about in the way of public safety against terrorism? Do you think he's doing enough?
Well, I mean, the French have to be concerned about that because I don't know if you remember this, Manila, but back in the 1980s, there was a spate of terrorist attacks in Paris where the radical Islamist groups were angry about French foreign policy in the Middle East, and they were bombing usually trash cans and mailboxes. And in fact, the city of Paris for a long time got rid of all the trash cans as a result of this. They put out these kind of crappy cardboard boxes so that there's not, I guess, barely enough room for a bomb, and I guess not enough room for the trash either, because the trash was just kind of like blow out of there. And it was a failed policy. But Paris has suffered terrorist attacks. Don't forget, as a cartoonist, I'm very cognizant of the Charlie Hebdo attack that claimed a dozen or so of my colleagues. And that was ISIS that did that. So there's like a lot of, it's an issue. Paris has a long history, like London, like England under the IRA period. But France's experience is more recent. It's been pretty safe, over the last 15, 20 years. But, you know, he's young, but he's old enough to remember that.
Now, speaking of preparations for the Olympics, remember back in 1936 when Germany hosted the Games? Back then, Führer Adolf Hitler was, you know, basically the Grand Marshal of the Games. It was a major PR victory for Hitler, seeing the swastika in every paper around the world. Berlin was draped in Nazi flags. But this year, there's one flag that is not going to be allowed to fly, despite a number of athletes from this country qualifying to compete. And of course, that's Russia. The Russian flag will not be flown. The IOC has ruled on it. The athletes can compete, but not under the national flag. This all stems from the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. What are your thoughts on this move by the IOC? I mean, specific to how it's treating Russia and the Russian athletes.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, people look back at the 1936 example and they say that's an example of, you know, the world should not have rewarded Hitler and the Nazis by holding the Olympics there. And that's certainly there's a valid argument to be made there. However, I would counter that it actually encouraged pretty relatively better behavior on the part of Hitler and the Nazis, because at least during that period, they weren't enforcing the Nuremberg laws and they had to keep it down. You know, they weren't beating up Jews in the streets of Berlin while this was going on. If you look at the historical accounts from that period, you know, the attention of the world was on Germany and they had to like play nice. I mean, you know, logically, if the world had been that engaged with Germany longer, it might have, you know, tamped down or maybe even forestalled the Holocaust. So I think engagement is always the answer if you think that a country is a rogue state. And I'm not saying that I think Russia is a rogue state for having invaded Ukraine, but it's like if in the West believe that the way that you're trying to improve behavior and make countries in other countries, like say North Korea or China or Iran, country, you know, rival states, antagonistic states, act more like you, then the answer is more engagement, not less engagement. It's less. And I don't think the Olympic Games should ever really be politicized. I mean, and it, whenever they do, you end up with these very strange things. Like, for example, you know, what do you do about the Kurds? You know, do Kurdish athletes, you know, they live in a de facto independent zone. What about people from the Transnistria? What about people, you know, athletes from Taiwan? They sort of have a Taiwanese national team, but I think they call it like Taipei or something like that, right? And, but it's like, so there's, it really shouldn't be up to them to determine that. And it's an absurdity when you're talking about not only a country like Russia, that not only is a massive country, the biggest on earth geographically, incredibly important culturally and politically, but on top, and you're like, we're just not going to let Russia, like, in, let's just say that you totally think the invasion of Ukraine is the worst thing in the world. Well, it's certainly no worse than the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Okay. And like the point is the U.S. didn't get kicked out of the Olympics. Right. So it's like Russia is being treated very, very poorly. And you're also talking about Russia, a major Olympic powerhouse for decades, because they've always, like, you know, unlike here, you know, if you ever watched iTanya, right, about Tanya Harding, like in Russia, if you're like a professional athlete, there's a whole governmental system to make sure you don't have to do anything else but just concentrate on practice and becoming a great athlete. Here, it's like something you do on the side while you're working at like friendlies or something. So it's like definitely, you know, like, so you're going to like take Russia out of the Olympics? It's absurd. I mean, it makes the Olympics look small. I don't think it hurts Russia nearly as much as it hurts the Olympics.
Yeah, good point on Taiwan. And you're absolutely right. For all of America's wars, the conflicts, funding of hostilities all around the world, the U.S. has never been banned from the games. Our flag has always been flown at these games.
Yeah.
All right, so there's recent outcry from a number of athletes, international organizations and the like from around the world about Israeli athletes competing in this year's games because of the ongoing onslaught in Gaza. Israel's flag, though, will fly in Paris. Its athletes will represent their country officially. So two things here. Is this hypocrisy or bias from the IOC in its treatment of Israel as compared to Russia? And given that the Israeli athletes can represent their country, but the Russian athletes can't, can you really separate the athlete from their home countries, or is this all just semantics?
I mean, absolutely, it's hypocrisy and it's favoritism, right? I mean, if, you know, look, what is the allegation here? You know, both, so Russia is engaged in a military operation in Ukraine that many countries and many people around the world oppose. Israel is engaged in a military operation in Gaza that many people around the world oppose. It's a very similar thing. And but they're being treated radically differently. And look, I'm in the interest of the IOC might be inconsistent, but I'm consistent. I think Russia should be able to participate. Look, we don't know what the personal opinions are of Russian athletes. For all we know, they're all against the special military occupation in Ukraine. Maybe they're all for it. They didn't. What is certain is that none of them had any decision making a power into this at all, right? They're not in the Russian parliament. They're not, they don't work in the Kremlin. They're athletes. And same thing with Israel. The Israeli athletes, we don't know how they personally feel about the invasion, about the operation going on in against Hamas in Gaza. For all we know, they might all be totally militantly opposed to it. And I don't care. And if they're for it, that's okay too. Because again, they're not the ones dropping bombs on the people of Gaza. It's like, no, athletes should not be held personally responsible for the actions of their government any more than Manila, you and I traveling overseas as tourists should be held accountable for the actions of the United States government. The government does their thing and we citizens do our thing. And it's absurd to hold individuals responsible for the actions of a government that they're not a part of.
Coming up next, an iconic author once called the Olympics war minus the guns. But with the increased politicization of sports, will the Olympics fade into history? We'll discuss it when we return with political cartoonist Ted Rall. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns. Here, we discuss some real news.
On March the 22nd, 1943, during the Great Patriotic War, the Schutzenmannschaft Battalion 118 burned down the Belarusian village of Khatyn.
Мы на улице играли, а потом пришли, победили, вышли на улицу и начали стрелять. Как начали стрелять, так у нас тут это кругом пули летели.
149 people died, including 75 children. The village was practically wiped off the face of the earth.
Пламя было, зарево было. Очень кричали, плакали. Но люди были порасползавшие. Вот, горело. А живые там никто не остался.
The infamous battalion responsible for the atrocity included over 100 Ukrainian nationalists from Western Ukraine.
И когда я прочитал и увидел, что это были украинцы, и там все были украинцы и по рождению, и по национальности, я спросил у нее, а почему нам об этом не рассказывают нигде никогда?
Declassified criminal cases from the Central Archive of the KGB of Belarus shed light on the atrocity and answer numerous questions that have remained unanswered for many years. Watch on RT.
Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. My buddy Ted Rall, political cartoonist and author, is back with us. So Ted, more broadly across the world of sports, over the decades, it seems we're increasingly seeing this sort of overlap of sports and politics. I mean, take the 1968 Mexico Games. Black American runners, you know, raising their fists in a show of solidarity for equal rights after winning gold and bronze medals, respectively. Or nowadays at NBA games, we see Black Lives Matter painted on the courts. NFL star Colin Kaepernick famously taking a knee during the national anthem. And now the Olympics forbidding one country's representation due to war, but not another country, which I think we could put squarely in the camp of politics. Should there be a separation of powers here, so to speak? I mean, like a separation of sports being sports, may the best athlete win and you know, just leave politics at the door? Or should the Olympics be used as a stage to promote a cause or send a message?
Well, I don't know that, like, when individuals who, you know, for example, the example of the black athletes in Mexico City in 1968, I don't know if that is wrong or right or wrong, was right or wrong, but certainly it's going to happen. When people are passionate about an issue, some of them are going to want to use their public forum in order to express it, and it's just going to happen. You know, I know Colin Kaepernick got a lot of for taking the knee, which I thought was a very, minor and very respectful and polite gesture. I thought it was extremely tempered, and I was surprised that sports fans were, conservatives in particular, were so angry about it. But I do think that, when you're talking about the broader issue of a nation state being that's participating in a, let's say, an unpopular war or a war that's unpopular in certain quarters, should they all be omitted? I mean, look, right now, Sudan and South Sudan are engaged in a military conflict. I haven't seen any discussion about banning one or both from participating at all. I mean, there are border skirmishes all the time, all around the world. Those are wars. And, if we're going to start saying that, like, everyone, every country that's involved in, like, you know, military tensions or war is not going to be allowed to attend the Olympic Games, well, pretty soon there's not going to be anyone there except like Vanuatu.
Well, what happens if some athletes refuse to play against Israel in solidarity with Gaza?
I think it's wrong. I think, look, the thing is that the spirit of international competition is about bringing people together from different countries and different cultures. You know, the athletes have a lot more in common because they all have the same love and this, and they all practice the same sport. They compete together. They have a lot more in common than they have to separate. And, you know, letting politics interfere is just really wrong. I would like to see a Palestinian team meet and hang out with their Israeli counterparts. That would be really nice to see. You know, it's just like to show that some people, even if the prime minister of Israel can't be mature and act like an adult, maybe athletes can. So, you know, it's, I believe in that. I mean, you know, that's, we live in a world where, I don't know, like, for example, the United Nations, when it becomes, you know, there's favoritism there. They say, okay, well, you know, we like this, but we don't like that. It's icky. You know, the whole point is we need more fora where people can get together and work things out. And it's not a free fire zone. It's a peaceful place where people can talk and get to know each other. I mean, kind of like the, you know, I hate the fact that like the International Space Station has gotten politicized. That's dumb. And everybody, and if you talk to either cosmonauts or astronauts, they will all say that like they really valued their time working with their Russian and or American counterparts, and they consider them to be lifelong friends. So, you know, they're all scientists. They all work together. I mean, that's the way it should be. That's, people are people, you know, I mean, people are the same everywhere. We just need to like, you know, get to know each other. I mean, honestly, you know, right now things are at such a fever pitch where the Israelis are terrified of the Palestinians. They think Palestinians want to kill them all. No, they don't. They just don't. They, and it's like, and you will be able to live side by side one day in a democratic state. Just as, and you know how I know that? Because I knew white South Africans before apartheid was over, and they were terrified that when apartheid went away, the blacks were going to come and kill them all. And that didn't happen. They all lived together in peace, side by side.
I've heard one scholar on this topic call sports a secular religion. Now, that said, the Olympic Games in particular definitely rile up nationalism and national pride. George Orwell famously said this about the Games, quote, "At the international level, sports is frankly mimic warfare. But the significant thing is not the behavior of the players, but the attitude of the spectators, and behind the spectators, of the nations who work themselves into furies over these absurd contests and seriously believe, at any rate for short periods, that running, jumping, and kicking a ball are tests of national virtue. It is a war minus the shooting." Final thoughts on that, Ted. Given all the atrocities going on right now, will the Olympics serve as a unifier or further divide the world?
Well, with all due respect to George Orwell, which is a considerable amount of respect, and I'm saying this as someone who, even as we speak, is working on reissuing my parody of Orwell's 1984, a loving parody, I think, you know, we can stand more wars minus the shooting. I think it's not a bad thing at all. I'm reminded of something I read about ancient history, the Assyrians and the Hittites in the Middle East, in what is today modern-day Syria and Lebanon. They kind of got tired of kicking each other's butts in battle. So they finally got to a point where they kind of agreed to sort of game out battle. So whenever they had any kind of conflict where they were going to have a war, the two armies would meet in a site of battle. But then instead of fighting, they would have analysts count up all the weapons and all the men. And then they'd say, all right, we think the Hittites would have won this battle. All right, accordingly, this city will be ceded to the Hittites from the Assyrians. Shake hands, everyone goes home. So that way you settle it, and it's without any bloodshed. The Hittites and the Assyrians were much smarter than we are.
Ted Rall, political cartoonist, author, and radio show host, thank you so much for your insight, buddy.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Manila.
All right. Before we go this time, a little news to share. This is the final episode of Modus Operandi. The show is sunsetting after 100 episodes of talking about unique, off-the-beaten-path topics that most would probably rather not discuss. I've had the incredible privilege of being invited into your homes and lives every week in these tumultuous times, and I could not be more grateful. We have put out 100 episodes that, in preparation for, I have learned so much, and I hope you've learned a bunch from each of them too. While this show is coming to a close, it means new opportunities for me to explore in the coming months and to operate in a new capacity in the world of international news within the RT family. But you can always find me on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, at Manila Chan, and you can subscribe to my podcast on Rumble, at Manila Chan Reports. So that is going to do it for Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in, and never stop trying to figure out the MO.